Welcome to our effects podcast. I'm John Montgomery. This week, we begin a two-part series as Mike Seymour chats with Paul Franklin from Double Negative Visual Effects about the work they did for Batman Begins. The London-based facility developed some interesting in-house techniques and workflow to create some beautiful imagery, helping bring director Christopher Nolan's vision of the movie to life. In part one of our interview with Paul Franklin, you'll see the kind of attention to detail that needs to take place for a project with a scope as large as Batman Begins. Let's go to Mike Seymour in Sydney.
Welcome to FX Guide, and I have Paul on the phone. Hello, Paul.
Hello there, Mike. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. Thanks so much for joining us. Can you let me know where you're speaking from right now?
Yeah, I'm talking to you from the offices of Double Negative Visual Effects. We're based in London, in the Soho District, right in the centre. And I am one of the visual effects supervisors here, and I was our visual effects supervisor for our work on Batman Begins over the last 18 months.
So, terrific job on the film. We really enjoyed it. It was great. I was wondering if we could just discuss some of the aspects of it. I thought we might have a look at some of the stuff that you brought into the film from photography and other things that you've done, as well as the use of miniatures, and then we'd work our way through to discussing some of the workflow issues that you guys used on the film.
Yeah, sure.
So let's start with one of the almost unsung characters of the film, which is actually the city of Chicago. Chicago featured pretty much as a basis for Gotham, didn't it?
Yes. Christopher Nolan, the director of Batman Begins, was very keen that the movie should have a strong grounding in reality. I think something that's been talked about a lot in various press articles about the film so far. And he wanted Gotham to feel very much as if it was a real place, a place that audiences would recognize when they saw it up on the screen. And I think he actually grew up partly in Chicago as a child. So he's very familiar with the city, and Chicago's got this fantastic soaring architecture, and it's also actually very friendly to filmmakers. The film board there in Illinois, the state of Illinois, makes it very easy for people to shoot movies in Chicago. And from a practical point of view, it's really good because the big high-rise skyscraper area, the downtown area, is actually a big financial district. And as such, it's pretty much empty after about 8 o'clock in the evening, so you can shut down the streets, lock everything down, and do car chases and shoot visual effects. So it's really good for that sort of thing.
And in fact, they helped you quite a bit at some point in actually clearing the streets, didn't they?
Yes, they did. I mean, it was also actually part of the requirements, safety requirements, for when we were shooting aerial plates with the space cam on the helicopters, because those of you who've seen the film will have seen that the chopper pretty much flies straight down the street, down the canyons of the city. And the Chicago City authorities insist that you can't have anybody down at street level. You're not allowed to have any traffic, no pedestrians, in case there's an accident and, God forbid, the chopper might crash. So on the one day when we have a big daytime aerial establisher of downtown Gotham as we watch the monorail train traveling into the center of the city towards Wayne Tower, its ultimate destination, you can see that below the train on the streets, the streets are teeming with traffic. There's cars zooming everywhere. All of those cars are created digitally because the city insisted on having nobody on the street. So it was completely locked down. It was like a complete ghost town. I think we had something like 150 production assistants on duty that day and 90 cops making sure that nobody got out onto the streets for that shot.
It really is one of those cases that there are things in this film that fall under a visual effect where you obviously assume it was a visual effect because of practical reasons, and a whole host of things that you seem to have done that are behind the scenes in just building, the classic seamless effects.
Yes, Chris Nolan was always very adamant that the visual effects were not going to grandstand in his film. He wasn't going to have visual effects take over from his preferred methods of storytelling, which is very much rooted in a sort of I suppose you might say an established language of cinematography, though obviously it's Chris Nolan's interpretation of these things. And one of the things that he was very keen to do is to always give this idea that Gotham is this enormous, endless city stretching off to the horizon. So a lot of the work we were doing with things like set extensions, background top-ups, getting rid of things which are overtly said you are in Chicago, like removing big landmark buildings like the Sears Tower and replacing them with other buildings that would just blend in seamlessly in the background. But then also Gotham is a city of various different districts. You have the Narrows Island, which is the sort of slum district, which is right in the center of the city, surrounded by the Chicago River. And all of that stuff had to be blended seamlessly together. But if ever it kind of drew attention to itself, Chris didn't like that. So we were under great pressure to make sure it was as seamless as it could be.
Ironically, one of the things that you're removing, which is, you know, very much a characteristic thing of Chicago, was the L. And yet the L, of course, is one of the things you then put back, albeit Gothamized.
Yes, that's true. The Gotham monorail, which has been in the film, it's established that it's been built by Bruce Wayne's father during this sequence we always refer to as the Gotham arrival, where the young Bruce travels into Gotham City on the monorail system with his parents. And the monorail was based in part upon the actual Chicago L train system, especially in with regards to the way that it's finished in that sort of shining metallic surface. One of the things that when we went out to Chicago, we were trying to think, well, what does the monorail actually look like? There was this idea that it would have this generally sort of bronzy finish to it, metallic finish, but we didn't quite know what the kind of surface characteristics of this thing would be. And then we saw the L trains in the glorious sunshine in Chicago, and they just look so fantastic, particularly for the opening sequence, which is portraying Gotham as being this optimistic, bright, go-ahead city when Bruce is a child, before it sort of slips into decay and crime and chaos for the latter part of the film. And the L train, it just sort of stuck out as being, this is the thing that that our monorail should look like. So we were very lucky that the guys at the Chicago Transit Authority actually gave us access to the train yards and spent half a day driving the trains around the yard for us so we could see the way that the light played across them. They gave us access to trains inside the repair shop so we could take lots and lots of detailed photographs. And we documented it pretty extensively.
I just wanted to ask you about the use of miniatures. There was some use of miniatures, I know, on the train, and we might come back to that. But also there were miniatures, of course, for the monastery and some of the other aspects, like I think you mentioned Narrows Island.
Yes.
What scale and how did you sort of decide, well, this is something that we want to shoot as a miniature versus this is something that we might do as CGI?
Well, I guess the thing that would define whether something played as a miniature or not was, if you look at something like the monorail train, for example, then it's, okay, that's a mechanical object. That lends itself to CGI. Something like the Narrows Island, which is which whilst it's built up from rectilinear building blocks for all the structures inside it, it has this very organic, layered quality to it. It has lots of cables and pipes draped over everything, like sort of almost like vines or tendrils completely out of control in this sort of higgledy-piggledy mass of this chaotic dwelling space. And that's the sort of thing that that type of complexity, computer graphics, CGI is not really that well suited to. It is possible to do it, but the investment, time and effort that would have to have been invested in creating systems to produce all those cables and the organic level of chaos in there and the fantastic level of detail, that kind of really didn't make sense to do. Whereas with a miniature, it plays really, really well.
What about the monastery, for example? Because that could have almost equally have been done either way, couldn't it?
Could have done that digitally, certainly for the scenes when you established the monastery. I think the miniature that was produced was absolutely fantastic, that the art department miniatures unit and then also the miniatures vendor, which is a company called Cutting Edge, did a tremendous job building the miniature monastery. The key thing with that is that the monastery has to blow up, and that's the sort of thing that miniatures still do really, really well, is pyrotechnics. You know, when you want to blow a building up, it's probably still a better idea to build it as a miniature, particularly in the case of the monastery, which is a wooden construction, so it splinters and fragments, and you have lots of interaction with the fire and the smoke, and that just works better, I think, as a miniature at this stage. Now, it's possible in the future you might be able to do those sorts of things as easily digitally, but right now miniatures play best there.
I know there was a 1/48th model of the monastery. Was there more than one monastery, or was it just one hero that you blew up?
Scale monastery for the big establishing shot, where we see the camera pulls up and out and reveals Bruce Wayne climbing up the slope towards the monastery, which is shrouded in a blizzard. That's a 48th scale miniature. And then there was a 24th scale miniature, which was used for the big pyro, when the monastery is blown up by Bruce Wayne as he's escaping from the League of Shadows.
Now, we touched on it earlier. There was also, at the end of the film, at the other end of the visual effects work, the crash of the train as it's heading into to Wayne Enterprises. And that was another miniature, wasn't it?
Yes. We're into a situation where we're blowing things up and smashing them up, and miniatures do that really, really well. So that was a very substantial miniature. That was a fifth-scale miniature of the train and the monorail towers. So the monorail towers were about, the miniatures were about 25 feet tall, and the surrounding buildings were, I think the tallest one was about 45 feet tall, the actual size of the miniature. Basically, that whole miniature set is a recreation of the end of LaSalle Street in Chicago, combined with some elements of the huge set that was built here at a place called Cardington, outside of London, which played for downtown Gotham. And then obviously we've added the monorail towers. Whenever you see Wayne Tower, though, in Wayne Station, that's always digital, but the rest of it was a miniature. And that's the only time that the miniature train actually plays in the film, is when you literally see it coming off the rails and then crashing through the underground car park where eventually it explodes.
We're talking to Paul Franklin about Batman Begins, and I'm just interested now to look at how you'd combine that miniature, the miniature of the train crashing at the end, because I know that you did some great work in sort of lens flares and getting some plugins for Shake to try and build that sequence out as it became digitally composited.
Yes, well, the whole movie, or all the principal photography, was shot on Panavision cameras. So it's an anamorphic film using vintage 1950s, I think they were C-series lenses, they might have been E-series, but they were one of the very first sets of anamorphic lenses ever manufactured. And they have very, very distinctive flare characteristics. They flare like anything. They're also quite soft by comparison to modern anamorphics, and they produce all sorts of other interesting distortions and aberrations. And it was essential for us, certainly with our fully digital scenes, to make sure that we gave all those characteristics to that material. But also with the miniatures work, the miniatures were primarily shot with spherical lenses on VistaVision, which Yannick Serres, who was the senior visual effects supervisor on the movie, he very much favours always doing miniatures on VistaVision if he can afford it. And so we had to make sure that all of our VistaVision material matched the look of the rest of the anamorphic principal photography. So what we did is we built quite a sophisticated lens analysis pipeline that we measured the distortion in the lenses, and then were able to apply that to our CG elements. And then also we could add the correct anamorphic distortion to spherical VistaVision plates. And then another thing we did was we measured under quite controlled conditions the flare patterns created by the anamorphic lenses. Our R&D supervisor, Oliver James, he had a custom mount fabricated for our Canon 10D digital SLR body, which allowed us to actually mount the Panavision lenses directly onto the SLR body. And then we photographed flare patterns created by the lenses digitally under controlled conditions, and then used those to generate a series of textures which would drive a custom Convolve plugin, which we then could apply to our composites in Shake later on. So basically what you'd do is you'd threshold the image, you'd hold out an area that you wanted to flare, you'd stick it through the Convolve plugin. The Convolve was then driven by the flare patterns, which had been recorded by Oliver's process. And we could recreate pretty accurate versions of the lens flares that we were getting in the principal photography. We also did other things. We created a plugin to generate the chromatic aberration, which gave these nice little red fringes around hot light sources. And there were a bunch of other things that were done as well to simulate all that. And that was all very, very important in tying it all together, I think.
And as that crash sequence happened, and you obviously had started to build it out digitally, I understand that you did some also really good work in matching the sort of smoke and steam that was playing a pivotal role as Batman sort of came through it.
Yeah, I mean, when you watch the film, you see these sequences where the Christian Bale stunt double, Buster Reeves, is doing this amazing stunt work on the wire flying through the steam plumes in the streets of Gotham. The steam was created by Chris Corbold's visual special effects team, who basically plumbed the whole set at Cardington and also out on location in Chicago. They had steam there as well, practical steam. They plumbed the whole set with steam pipes underneath the floor, driven by this enormous steam boiler the size of a very large articulated lorry at the back of the set. A big 18-wheeler, a steam boiler that size, you can imagine, which then fed these colossal iron pipes which ran all along the sides of the studio and then under the floor. And these produced these fantastic jets of water vapor, which would go up anything up to like 70, 80 feet up in the air, which when they'd been running for a little while, it would the whole shed, the studio shed that we were actually in, this massive hangar that had been used to build the Gotham set, basically turned into being inside a tropical rainforest or something, with just these clouds of rolling steam. And we thought, okay, well, we're going to have to recreate all this stuff for our visual effects shots. And the original intention was to shoot elements, just isolate the steam plumes against black, and then stick these things onto cards and then dress them into our 3D scenes as basically big animated textures. But it was, even though we did shoot elements, we did use those in a few places, it was pretty obvious early on that the camera moves that we were going to do, we were going to be flying through the steam plumes, we were going to be flying around them, we were traveling at great speed. We'd also be seeing them from angles that we just could not get our elements from. We couldn't shoot the high angles that we needed on the elements. So we decided instead to invest a bit of time in R&D and actually develop our own in-house volumetric rendering toolset, which is a renderer called DNB, which stands for Double Negative Renderer B. We have another renderer called DNA, which is a custom sprite rendering toolset, which was actually used for in the scene with the monastery with the snow. We actually used that to help create the snowstorm. But DNB was a fully featured standalone rendering package with its own shading language, which provided for features such as backscattering of the light, so that we could match all the optical effects that we were getting on set. And then the actual steam plume animation is driven by Maya Fluids simulations, but then exporting it out to a proprietary particle database format, which then acts as the bridge to get it into DNB. And the key thing is that there are off-the-shelf solutions. You could go and use something like Mental Ray or even Maya's own native fluids renderer, which do produce pretty good results, but they're really quite slow, and we needed something that was highly optimized. And DNB really screamed through the rendering, and actually the bottleneck became the fluid simulations. DNB was also used to create the smoke plumes coming off the crash site, which features in a couple of the final shots, which we had to match into the look of the miniature smoke and Fuller's Earth that was flying around during the miniature shoot for the crash scene.
Because that was one of the other miniatures that was used, wasn't it? There was certain one-third scale models of the Batmobile that were used in some sequences?
Yes, there was during the car chase, which is plays in the middle of the film, there's a moment where the Batmobile gets up onto the top of a parking garage, and he's Batman surrounded by the cops, and you think, oh, well, you know, he's stuffed there, he'll have to get out of the car. But instead, he blows a hole in the wall and then just basically flies the Batmobile. It leaps from one building to another in this amazing moment where it's jumping across the rooftops, what we refer to as the rooftop chase. That was primarily a third-scale miniature. The guys built a third-scale miniature Batmobile, which is about 5 feet long, which is radio-controlled and fully detailed. It was a very, very good match for the full-size Batmobile. They also had a variety of slightly less detailed stunt bugs of the miniature Batmobile, which they could fire off launchers for when you see it flying through the air on its kind of ballistic trajectories. And that was interesting, the way that whole thing was approached, because none of that work was done with motion control. It was all shot with techno cranes and manually operated cameras, which was very much, again, in accordance with Chris Nolan's philosophy that he wanted the miniatures unit to find the shots. He didn't want to have everything pre-planned as a series of animatics and then just export it to a motion control unit. He wanted to have a much more spontaneous feel to things.
So that sort of brings up an interesting point, doesn't it? Because, in fact, you were working without a whole lot of detailed previs, and yet, in the other sense, it sounds like you had a really good, healthy amount of R&D planning time.
We did. We were very lucky that Yannick Sears and Dan Glass, who was Yannick's co-supervisor on the movie, they really appreciate the benefits of actually having a decent amount of time to plan things and be able to get your tool sets in place. And this, from their point of view, this is even more important on this movie because Chris Nolan, as you mentioned, he's not the guy who wanted to use a great deal of previs or even storyboards. You know, Chris, he likes to get all his ideas together, keeps them in his head, and then goes out on set and then, you know, sees what he'll actually find when he's actually out there on set. And he kind of, you know, it's a very spontaneous, inventive way of filmmaking, but obviously not really conducive to a heavily pre-planned visual effects approach. So the whole idea of our R&D phase was to develop a whole range of responses to any of the kind of possible things that Chris might throw in our direction when he was out on set doing the principal photography. And as such, we planned a pretty comprehensive way of creating digital backdrops, particularly for the miniature sequences, or like the stuff I was just talking about for the Batmobile, recreating the whole of the parking garage area around the Batmobile. Around the Batmobile chase, and then also later on when we're seeing the big digital cityscapes. But we did use previs in as much as we were using it for shot planning, just like kind of working out, you know, what was the scale of the problem we were actually getting into, you know, how big green screens we'd be using, you know, where we might be able to get the cameras, what sort of coverage we might be able to get when we were actually out on set with main unit.
Paul, we're going to take a short break there. When we come back, we'd like to go through some of those workflow techniques that you developed over that lead-in period that you had on the film. And in particular, we'll get it sort of technical with the process from what you were shooting in Chicago right through to some of the final composites.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of our homepage. This podcast is copyright 2005 FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide, LLC.